Thomas Kane,
country,
who is the
in a number of different ways, both in the volunteer
chairman of the
level,
commission, is now welcoming
level,
Secretary of State Colin Powell.
This is AM 580 WILL Urbana. You're listening to live coverage from National Public Radio of hearings by the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States. Upcoming witness expected to be current Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Coming, Mr. Secretary, Mr. Deputy Secretary, we would like, if we could, to ask you to raise your right hand that we may put you under oath. Do you swear or affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you very much. Secretary Powell, your prepared statement will be entered into the record in full. We would ask you, therefore, if we could summarize your remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a great pleasure to be before the Commission today, and I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you regarding the events leading up to and following the murderous terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. It is my hope, as I know it is yours, that through the hard work of this Commission, our country can improve the way we wage the war on terror, and in particular, better protect our homeland and the American people. I'm pleased to have, of course, with me today Deputy Secretary Richard Armitage. Rich Armitage, Secretary Armitage, was sworn in on March 26th of 2001, 2 months into the administration, and he's been intimately involved in the interagency deliberations on our counterterrorism policies. And, of course, he also participated in what are known as principles as well as National Security Council meetings whenever I was on travel or otherwise unavailable. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I leave Washington this evening to represent President Bush and the American people at the memorial service in Madrid, Spain, honoring the over 200 victims of the terrorist attacks of 3/11, March 11, 2004. With deep sympathy and solidarity, our heart goes out to their loved ones and to the people of Spain. And just last Thursday, in the garden of our embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, I presided at a memorial service in honor of two State Department family members, Barbara Green and her daughter, Kristen Wormsley, who were killed 2 years ago by terrorists while they worshipped in a church on a bright, beautiful spring morning. I know that the families and friends of the victims of 9/11, some of whom are listening and watching today, grieve just as the Spanish are grieving and just as we at the Department of State did and still do for Barbara and Kristen. Mr. Chairman, I am no newcomer to the horrors of terrorism. In 1983, Secretary Armitage and I were working for Secretary of Defense Cap Weinberger, as was Secretary Lehman at that time, when 243 wonderful, brave Marines and Navy corpsmen were killed in Beirut, Lebanon. I was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1993 when the first bombing of the World Trade Center took place. In 1996, I may have been out of government, while I followed closely the events surrounding the Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia. Khobar and all the other terrorist attacks over the years were very much part of my consciousness as I prepared to assume the office of Secretary of State under President George Bush. I was well aware of the fact that I was going to be sworn into office just 3 months after the USS Cole was struck in the harbor at Aden, Yemen, taking the lives of 17 sailors and wounding 30 others. I was well aware, very well aware, that our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania had been blown up in 1998, injuring some 4,000 people and killing 220, 12 of them Americans, the highest number of casualties in a single incident in the State Department's history. As the new Chief Executive Officer of the Department of State, I was acutely aware that I would be responsible to President Bush, and he made this clear that this was my responsibility, for the safety of the men and women serving at our post overseas, as well as for the safety and welfare of private American citizens traveling and living abroad. The 1999 Crow Commission report on embassy security became our blueprint for upgrading the security of all of our facilities. Admiral Crow had done an extensive review and made some scathing criticisms on how lax our country was in protecting our personnel who were serving abroad from terrorist attacks. And one of my first actions was to ask retired Major General Chuck Williams of the Army Corps of Engineers to come into the department and head our building operation. We wanted him to move aggressively to implement the Crow recommendations and to protect our people and our installations. And he has done a tremendous job of that. At the beginning of this administration, we were building one new secure embassy a year. Today, we are building 10 new secure embassies every single year. As the President's principal foreign policy advisor, I was well aware, as was the President, all the members of the new national security team that communism and fascism, our old foes of the past century, had been replaced by a new kind of enemy, terrorism. We were well aware that no nation is immune to terrorism. We were well aware that this adversary is not necessarily a state and that often has no clear return address. We knew that this monster is Hydra-headed, many-tentacled. We knew that its evil leaders and followers espouse many false causes but have one common purpose, to murder innocent people. Mr. Chairman, President Bush and all of us on his team knew that terrorism would be a major concern for us, as it has been for the past several administrations. During the transition from the Clinton to the Bush administration, we were pleased to receive the briefings and information that Secretary Albright and her staff provided us on President Clinton's counterterrorism policies and what they had done for the previous 8 years before we came into office. Indeed, on December 20th, four days after President Bush announced that I would be the next Secretary of State, I asked for and got a briefing on our worldwide terrorism actions and policies from President Clinton's counterterrorism security group, headed by Mr. Dick Clark. In addition to Mr. Clark, at this briefing, my very first briefing during the transition, also present were the CIA's counterterrorism director, Mr. Kofor Black, from the FBI, Dale Watson, also present were representatives from the Department of Defense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and from within the State Department, representatives of our own Bureau of Intelligence and Research, as well as our acting coordinator for counterterrorism. A major component of this briefing was al-Qaeda's growing threat to the United States, our interests around the world, and Afghanistan's role as a safe haven for al-Qaeda. As a matter of fact, that part of the briefing got my attention, so much so that later I asked Mr. Armitage, when he got sworn in, to get directly involved in all these issues, and he did. In addition, in my transition book that was provided to me by Secretary Albright, there was a paper from Mike Sheehan, Secretary Albright's counterterrorism coordinator, and I read it very carefully. That transition paper under the rubric Ongoing Threat Environment stated that, quote, in close coordination with the intelligence community, we must ensure that all precautions are taken to strengthen our security posture, warn U.S. citizens abroad, and maintain a high level of readiness to respond to additional incidents that might come along. The paper informed me that, quote, the joint U.S.-Yemeni investigation of the USS Cole bombing continues to develop new information and leads, but that it is still too early to definitively link the attack to a sponsor, i.e. Osama bin Laden. And under Taliban, the paper records that we must continue to rally international support for a new round of UN sanctions, including an arms embargo against the Taliban. The paper further stated we should maintain the momentum of getting others, such as the G8, Russia, India, the Caucasus states, Central Asia, to isolate and pressure the Taliban. It continued, if the Cole investigation leads back to Afghanistan, we should use it to mobilize the international support needed for further pressures on the Taliban. Let me emphasize that the paper covered a range of terrorism-related concerns, and not just al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So the outgoing administration provided me and others in the incoming administration with transition papers as well as briefings based on their 8 years of experience that reinforced our awareness of the worldwide threat from terrorism. All of us on the Bush National Security Team, beginning with President Bush, knew we needed continuity in counterterrorism policy. We did not want terrorists to see the early months of a new administration as a time of opportunity. And for continuity, President Bush retained Director Tenet at the CIA. Director Tenet's counterterrorism center remained under the leadership of Kofor Black. He was kept on there until he joined the State Department last year to become my Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism. Dick Clark was retained at the National Security Council. I retained Ambassador Edmund Hull as acting coordinator for counterterrorism until I was able to bring a new team in a little bit later in the year under the leadership of former Brigadier General Frank Taylor of the United States Air Force's Office of Special Investigations. He was Kofor Black's immediate predecessor. I also retained David Carpenter as Assistant Secretary for Diplomatic Security and kept Tom Finger on as Acting Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research. Christopher Kojim, now a staff member of your commission, was a political appointee from the prior administration, and we kept him on as well in order to show continuity during this period. And, of course, FBI Director Louis Freeh provided continuity on the domestic side. Early on, we made clear to the Congress and to the American people that we understood the scope and compelling nature of the threat from terrorism. For example, on February 7th, 2001, just a few weeks into the administration, my acting Assistant Secretary for Intelligence, Tom Finger, who had served in the same capacity in the previous administration, testified before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence regarding threats to the United States. In the first part of his testimony, he highlighted the threat from unconventional forces, saying, "The magnitude of each individual threat is small, but in aggregate, unconventional threats probably pose a more immediate danger to Americans than do foreign armies, nuclear weapons, long-range missiles, or the proliferation even of weapons of mass destruction and delivery systems." Mr. Finger then went on to single out Osama bin Laden, saying that plausible, if not always credible, threats linked to his organizations target Americans and America's friends or interests on almost every continent. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, the Department of State was well aware of the terrorist threat. Excuse me. The new Bush administration, as had the Clinton administration, created counterterrorism and regional interagency committees to study the counterterrorism issue in a comprehensive way. The committees, in turn, reported to a deputies committee chaired by Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, on which Mr. Armitage was my representative. The deputies, in turn, reported to cabinet-level principals committees, which answered to the National Security Council, chaired by the President. These committees, however, were not by any means the sum and substance of our interagency discussions on counterterrorism, nor did they represent all that was happening in the administration on a day-to-day basis. In order to keep in constant touch on counterterrorism issues, as well as all of the other items on our agenda, Secretary Rumsfeld, Dr. Rice, and I held a daily coordination phone call meeting on every morning that we were in town at 7:15. In addition to our regular and frequent meetings at the State Department every morning at 8:30, I met with my staff and immediately had available at 8:30 information for my INR section, my intelligence people, as well as my counterterrorism coordinator, as well as the Assistant Secretary in charge of diplomatic security. We formalized regular luncheons with Dr. Rice, myself, the Vice President, and Secretary Rumsfeld in order to make sure that we stayed in closest touch with each other, not only on terrorism, but on all issues. Above all, from the start, the President, by word and deed, made clear his interest and his intense desire to protect the nation from terrorism. He frequently asked and prodded us to do more. He decided early on that we needed to be more aggressive in going after terrorists, and especially Al-Qaeda. As he said in early spring, as we were developing our new comprehensive strategy, quote, "I'm tired of swatting flies." He wanted a thorough, comprehensive diplomatic, military, intelligence, law enforcement, and financial strategy to go after Al-Qaeda. It was a demanding order, but it was a necessary one. There were many other compelling issues that were on our agenda that a new administration has to take into account. A Middle East policy that had just collapsed. The sanctions on Iraq had been unraveling steadily since 1998. Relations with Russia and China were complicated by the need to expel Russian spies in February and the plane collision with a Chinese fighter in April. There were many foreign leaders who were coming to the United States or wanted us to visit them to get engaged with the new administration. Yes, we had to deal with all of these pressing matters and more, but we also were confident that we had an experienced counterterrorism team in place. President Bush and his entire national security team understood that terrorism had to be among our highest priorities, and it was. Now, what did we do to act on that priority? Our counterterrorism planning developed very rapidly, considering the challenges of transition and of a new administration. We were not given a counterterrorism action plan by the previous administration. As I mentioned, we were given good briefings on what they had been doing with respect to Al-Qaeda and with respect to the Taliban. The briefers, as well as the principals, conveyed to us the gravity of the threat posed by Al-Qaeda. But we noted early on that the actions that the previous administration had taken had not succeeded in eliminating the threat. As a result, Dr. Rice directed a thorough policy review aimed at developing a comprehensive strategy to eliminate the al-Qaeda threat. And this was in her first week in her new position as National Security Advisor. This decision did not await any deputies or principals committee review. She knew what we had to do, and she put us to the task of doing it. We wanted the new policy to go well beyond tit-for-tat retaliation. We felt that lethal strikes that largely miss the terrorist if you don't have adequate targeting information, such as the cruise missile strikes in 1998, might lead al-Qaeda to believe that we lacked resolve. These strikes had obviously not deterred al-Qaeda from subsequently attacking the USS Cole. We wanted to move beyond the rollback policy of containment, criminal prosecution, and limited retaliation for specific terrorist attacks. We wanted to destroy al-Qaeda. We understood that Pakistan was critical to the success of our long-term strategy. To get at al-Qaeda, we had to end Pakistan's support for the Taliban, so we had to recast our relations with that country. But nuclear sanctions caused by Pakistan's nuclear weapons tests and the nature of the new regime, the way President Musharraf took office, made it difficult for us to work with Pakistan. We knew, however, that achieving sustainable new relations with Pakistan meant moving more aggressively to strengthen and shape our relations with India as well. So we began this rather more complex diplomatic approach very quickly upon assuming office, even as we were putting the strategy on paper and deciding its other more complicated elements. For example, in February of 2001, Presidents Bush and Musharraf exchanged letters. Let me quote a few lines from President Bush's February 16th letter to President Musharraf of Pakistan. This was just a few weeks after coming into office. Quote, the President said to President Musharraf, "Pakistan is an important member of the community of nations and one with which I hope to build better relations, particularly as you move ahead to return to civilian constitutional government. We have concerns of which you are aware, but I am hopeful we can work together on our differences in the years ahead. We should work together," the President continued, "to address Afghanistan's many problems. The most pressing of these is terrorism, and it inhibits progress in all other issues. The continued presence of Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda organization is a direct threat to the United States and its interests that must be addressed. I believe al-Qaeda also threatens Pakistan's long-term interest. We join the United Nations in passing additional sanctions against the Taliban to bring bin Laden to justice and to close the network of terrorist camps in their territory." The President concluded, "I urge you to use your influence with the Taliban to bring this about." President Bush was very concerned about al-Qaeda and about the safe haven given them by the Taliban, but he knew that implementing the diplomatic roadmap we envisioned would be difficult. The deputies went to work reviewing all of these complex regional issues. Early on, we realized that a serious effort to remove al-Qaeda's safe haven in Afghanistan might well require introducing military force, especially ground forces. This, without the cooperation of Pakistan, would be out of the question. Pakistan had vital interests in Afghanistan and was deeply suspicious of India's intentions. Pakistan's and India's mutual fears and suspicion threatened to boil over into nuclear conflict as the administration got into the early months of its existence. To put it mildly, the situation was delicate and dangerous. Any effort to effect change had to be calibrated very carefully to avoid misperception and miscalculation. Under the leadership of Steve Hadley, Deputy National Security Advisor, the deputies met a number of times during the spring and summer to craft a strategy for eliminating the al-Qaeda threat and dealing with the complex implications for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. So we began to develop this more aggressive and more comprehensive strategy. And while we did so, we continued activities that had been going on in the previous administration aimed at al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, including intelligence activities. For example, during the summer of 2001, the CIA succeeded in a number of disruption activities against terrorist groups. These are activities where our agents create turmoil among those groups they know to be associated with terrorists so that the terrorists cannot assemble, cannot communicate, can't effectively plan, receive any support or money, and are generally unable to act in a coordinated fashion. You will hear more about these activities from Director Tenet tomorrow, but I want to emphasize that notwithstanding all these intelligence activities that were underway, at no time during the early months of our administration were we presented with a vetted, viable operational proposal which would have led to an opportunity to kill, capture, or otherwise neutralize Osama bin Laden. Never received any targetable information. Let me return now to our diplomatic efforts. From early 2001 onward, we pressed the Taliban directly and sought the assistance of the government of Pakistan and other neighboring states to put additional pressure on the Taliban to expel bin Laden from Afghanistan and to shut down al-Qaeda. On February 8, 2001, less than 3 weeks into the administration, we closed the Taliban office in New York, implementing the UN resolutions passed the previous month, I must say, with the strong support and the dedicated efforts of Secretary Albright and Undersecretary Pickering. In March, we repeated the warning to the Taliban that they would be held responsible for any al-Qaeda attack against our interest. In April 2001, senior departmental officials traveled to Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, the Kyrgyz Republic, Tajikistan, to lay out our key concerns, including about terrorism and Afghanistan. We asked these Central Asian nations to coordinate their efforts with the various Afghan players who were opposed to the Taliban. We also used what we call the Bond Group of concerned countries to bring together Germany, Russia, Iran, Pakistan, and the United States to build a common approach to Afghanistan. At the same time, we encouraged and supported the Rome Group of expatriate Afghans to explore alternatives to the Taliban. In May, Deputy Secretary Armitage met with First Deputy Foreign Minister Trubnikov of the Russian Federation to renew the work of the U.S.-Russia Working Group in Afghanistan. These discussions had previously been conducted at a lower level. We focused specifically on what we could do together about Afghanistan and about the Taliban. This, incidentally, laid the groundwork for obtaining Russian cooperation on liberating Afghanistan immediately after 9/11.
Mr. Secretary, mid-June. We are going to run out of time.
Yes, I will get shorter.
Thank you, sir.
I just wanted to make the point that in June and July and August, we took every effort that was available to us to put pressure on Pakistan to cut its losses with the Taliban and to take every effort possible to make sure that Pakistan understood the need to bring Afghanistan around to eliminating the threat provided by al-Qaeda and its presence in Afghanistan. We also put into a play a number of other options that were available to us. As we know, during this period, we looked at some of the ideas that Mr. Clark's team had presented that had not been tried in the previous administration. These activities fit the long-term time frame of our new strategy and were presented to us that way by Mr. Clark. In other words, these were long-term actions that he had in mind and not immediate actions that would produce immediate results. If these ideas made sense, we explored them. If they look workable, we adopted them. For example, we provided new counterterrorism aid to Uzbekistan because we knew al-Qaeda was sponsoring a terrorist effort in that country led by the Islamic movement. We looked at the Predator. The Predator at that time, in early 2001, was not an armed weapon that could be used to go after anyone. And Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Tenet will talk more about this. But by the end of that summer period, and as we entered September and October, it was a weapon that was usable, and it was used extensively and effectively after 9/11 when it was ready. Other ideas, such as arming the Northern Alliance with significant weaponry or giving them an added capability, did not seem to be a practical thing to do at that time for the same sorts of reasons that Secretary Albright discussed earlier. The basic elements of our new strategy, which came together during these early months of the administration, first and foremost, eliminate al-Qaeda. It was no longer to roll it back or reduce its effectiveness. Our goal was to destroy it. Strategy would call for ending all sanctuaries given to al-Qaeda. We would try to do this first through diplomacy, but if diplomacy failed, and there was a call for additional measures, including military operations, we would be prepared to do it. And military action would be more than just launching cruise missiles at already warned targets. In fact, the strategy called for attacking al-Qaeda and the Taliban's leadership, their command and control, their ground forces, and other targets. The strategy would recognize the need for significant aid, not only to the Northern Alliance, but to other tribal groups that might help us with this. It would also include greatly expanding intelligence and authorities, capabilities, and funding. While all this was taking place, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we did everything we could to protect the lives of American citizens around the world. As you know, the threat information that we were receiving from the CIA and other sources suggested that we were increasingly at risk, and the risk was looked to be mostly overseas. And while that is my responsibility, others in our administration were looking at the threat within the United States. But in response to these overseas threats, we issued threat warnings constantly. Every time the threat level went up, we would respond with appropriate threat warnings to our embassies, to our citizens around the world who were traveling or living in foreign countries, warning them of the nature of the threat and encouraging them to take the necessary cautions. So it is not as if we weren't responding to the threat. We were responding to the threat in the ways that we could respond to the threat, with warnings, with emergency action committee meetings in our embassies to make sure that we were buttoning down and buttoning up. Mr. Chairman, this all continued throughout the summer. It reached a conclusion in early September when all the pieces of our strategy came together, the intelligence part, the diplomatic part, military components of it, law enforcement, the nature of the challenge we had before us, which was to eliminate Al-Qaeda. It all came together on the 4th of September at a principals meeting where we concluded our work on the national security directive that would be telling everybody in the administration what we were going to do as we move forward. It took us roughly 8 months to get to that point, but it was a solid 8 months of dedicated work to bring us to that point. And then, as we all know, 9/11 hit, and we had to accelerate all of our efforts and go on to a different kind of footing altogether. I just might point out that with respect to Pakistan, consistent with the decisions that we had made in early September, after 9/11, within 2 days, Mr. Armitage had contacted the Pakistani intelligence chiefs who were happened to be in the United States and laid out what we now needed from Pakistan. The time for diplomacy and discussions were over. We needed immediate action. And Mr. Armitage laid out 7 specific steps for Pakistan to take to join us in this effort. We gave them 48 hours to consider it, and then I called President Musharraf and said, we need your answer now. We need you as part of this campaign, this crusade. And President Musharraf made a historic and strategic decision that evening when I spoke to him, changed his policy and became a partner in this effort as opposed to a hindrance to the effort. Mr. Chairman, I have to also say that we were successful during this period in rounding up international support, the OAS, Organization of the Islamic Conference, the United Nations, NATO, the entire international community rallied to our effort. To summarize all of this, Mr. Chairman, I might say that this administration came in fully recognizing the threat presented to the United States and its interests and allies around the world by terrorism. We went to work on it immediately. The President made it clear it was a high priority. The interagency group was working. We had continuity in our counterterrorism institutions and organizations. We kept demarching, as was done in the previous administration. But while we were demarching, and while we were doing intelligence activities to disrupt, we were putting in place a comprehensive strategy that pulled all of these things together in a more aggressive way and in a way that would go after this threat in order to destroy it and not just keep demarching it. We had 8 or so months to do that, and in early September, that strategy came together. And when 9/11 hit us and brought us to that terrible day that none of us will ever forget, that strategy was ready, and it was the basis upon which we went forward and we could accelerate all of our efforts. While I was warning embassies and taking cover in our embassies in response to the threats, Secretary Rumsfeld was doing the same thing with military forces. Director Tenet was doing the same thing with his assets around the world. And our domestic agencies, the FBI, the FAA, were also looking at what they needed to protect the nation. Most of us still thought that the principal threat was outside of the country. We didn't know while we were going through this procedure and through these policies and putting together this comprehensive strategy that those who were going to perpetrate 9/11 were already in the country, had been in the country for some time, and were hard at work. anything we might have done against al-Qaeda during this period, against Osama bin Laden, may or may not have any influence on these people who are already in the country, already had their instructions, already burrowed in, and were getting ready to commit the crimes that we saw on 9/11. Nevertheless, we knew that al-Qaeda was ultimately the source of this kind of terror, and we determined to go after it. As Secretary Albright said earlier, we have many other things we have to do in the months and years ahead. We have to get our message out. We have to do more with public diplomacy. We have to do more with our allies and with our partners around the world. We are working on all of these issues. But al-Qaeda no longer has a safe haven in Afghanistan. The people of Afghanistan are on their way to democracy. It was there last week. There are going to be no more weapons of mass destruction or safe havens in Iraq. The people of Iraq have been liberated, and they're on their way to a democracy. And so I think we're trying to create conditions where we will bring the whole civilized world together against the threat of terrorism. Mr. Chairman, I will end at this point, and my entire statement is available for your record.
Mr. Secretary, thank you
Secretary
very much.
Secretary of State Colin Powell.
We'll begin this round of questioning with Commissioner Thompson, followed by Commissioner Gorelick.
Governor James Thompson,
Secretary,
Republican of Illinois, will be the first to question.
This morning in written form has come close to this issue, but let me ask you directly. In the 7 months between the time the Bush administration took office and September 11th, to your knowledge, did Mr. Clark ever present to the Bush administration a new plan for dealing with al-Qaeda, or was he, along with the rest of the NSC staff and the counterterrorism group, working on the NSPD that was eventually produced in September without any complaint that things had to be done before that time?
To the best of my knowledge, and I'll ask Deputy Secretary Armitage to comment on this because he was so intimately involved, is that in the early part of the seven-month period and coming to sort of a climax in April, we started to pull together the various threads of a new policy. But I'm not aware of a specific new plan that had been put forward. Dr. Rice had asked for a comprehensive study to be done of everything that we were doing up to that point from the previous administration, any new ideas that would come along. But I'm not aware of a specific new plan that was presented for consideration by the principals for action by the National Security Council.
No, I did not see a plan either, but it's quite clear, Governor, that
this is
Dick Clark,
Richard
who participated
Armitage
in most of the
State
DCs
Department.
In which I deputies committee meetings in which I participated, was quite impatient and was pushing the process quite well.
Mr. Secretary, taking into account both your military background and your present diplomatic position, in your opinion, would military aid to the Northern Alliance during the period February 91 to September 91 have prevented 9/11?
No.
Would more frequent principals' meetings in that period or more small group meetings in that period prevented 9/11?
No, and I'm not quite sure I've followed the rationale between more meetings and preventing 9/11. We met constantly. It wasn't always at principals level, but there was no lack of communication between the principals. There was no lack of exchange of information and data. I was briefed every morning by my intelligence people, so were all of the other principals. The president got daily briefings from the director of Central Intelligence. And we consulted with each other about all of these issues. So I don't think it was a lack of meetings that resulted in 9/11, if that's the suggestion.
In your opinion, would an invasion of Afghanistan between February of 91 and September
occasions.
Of 91
it's
prevented
the meetings
September
at the level
I,
of
I
heads of departments
that,
or secretaries.
That those
and then there are deputies meetings, which are the number two or number three or designated hitter who meets
the attacks of 9/11.
On behalf of the secretaries and heads of departments.
They had their instructions, they had their plans in place, and they were in the process of infiltrating themselves into the United States, or they were already here. and invading Afghanistan and cutting off the head, if you succeeded in getting Osama bin Laden and disrupting al-Qaeda at that point, I have no reason to believe that would have caused them to abort their plans.
In fact, NATO is in Afghanistan today, and yet everyone who has testified before this commission or been interviewed by this commission still fears that we may yet suffer another attack on our own soil. Is that not correct?
That's correct. Al-Qaeda has tentacles in many different parts of the world. We've been very successful. We believe we have eliminated a significant portion of the senior leadership that we knew about, but this does not eliminate the entire organization, and it is not the only organization that means us ill.
Let me take you back to the time you took office early in 1991. Would you give us a summary version of the most pressing foreign policy issues that the nation, in your opinion, faced, how you rank them, and where counterterrorism fit into this order of priority?
There's no question that counterterrorism was in the top tier on this list. It's very difficult to rank order them because they just come rushing in at you, and some you have to deal with them as they come. I would say the Middle East peace problem was right there, one of the top ones. The discussions that President Clinton and Mrs. Albright, Dr. Albright, were having with the Palestinians and Israelis had essentially fallen apart just before inauguration. And in fact, President Clinton and I spoke about it on his last day in office that afternoon of January 19th and expressed his disappointment that it didn't work. So that was a top one. Sanctions were falling apart with respect to Iraq, and we had to arrest that collapse of the sanctions policy. We were interested in a new relationship, what our relationship would be with Russia, with China. And so lots of things press in, and you have to deal with all of them. But there's no doubt that counterterrorism and terrorism was high on that list. The very reason the very first briefing I got was on terrorism. And Dr. Albright, Secretary Albright, certainly made clear that she thought it was a high priority. I was announced on Saturday, the 16th, and the very next day, Sunday the 17th, I met with Dr. Albright at her home for the first time to start talking about these issues.
In May of 1991, you testified before the Senate Appropriations Committee. And you said, in my first 3 months, I'm very satisfied with the level of interagency coordination and cooperation. And you made specific reference to the FBI and the CIA. Now, I realize you're only on the job 3 months at that time, but in light of what we've all heard since that time about the difficulties in getting the FBI and the CIA together on the issue of al-Qaeda, do you think you were being a little optimistic about the degree of coordination?
I was getting a steady stream of information from Director Tenet. I read the same thing the President read every morning, and the PDB, as it's known, and you're well familiar with it. The PDB regularly talked about terrorist activities. My own intelligence operation, INR, fed me with a steady stream. I met on a regular basis, with Director Free. I had access to FBI information. So I didn't feel that there was a lack of coordination or a lack of communications and interchange between the principals.
All of us, I'm sure, have a strong desire to prevent another Afghanistan. And there are places in the world, are there not, Mr. Secretary, either in Africa or Southeast Asia that present that threat? Would you tell us, please, what the administration and you are doing both diplomatically and militarily to head off this threat of another Afghanistan?
Right after 9/11, even before 9/11, we started to work with the countries of Central Asia. Uzbekistan, we knew, would be an important nation in this regard. And after 9/11, we put a full-court press on all of the nations of Central Asia, not only for access for our troops to do their work in Afghanistan, but to create new relations with them. And all of them have expressed a desire to have a friendly relationship, and in some cases a partnership with the United States. And we did this very sensitive to Russia's concerns about the United States being in that part of the world. But we were able to persuade the Russians over time that we had a common enemy in terrorism, and they should not fear the United States having these kinds of relations with Central Asian nations. We also looked at some of the nations in Africa, for example, Somalia, which is without a government. Secretary Rumsfeld, I'm sure he'll testify to this, has been looking at our footprint around the world to see how best we can deploy our forces to deal with those nations of the world and those regions of the world that have the potential of serving as safe havens for terrorist activities. For example, we have a presence in Djibouti now that we didn't have previously because we're concerned about the possibility of terrorists finding safe havens in that part of the world. So I think we have, through our diplomatic efforts, our intelligence efforts, and our military footprinting, been very sensitive to the need to get ahead of the terrorist and to dry up these fertile places. Part of our public diplomacy effort goes to this effort as well.
One last question.
If I may.
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
There's one other element that the Secretary has made a big part of our policy, the Department of State.
Deputy Secretary,
and that is
Richard
that a big
Armitage.
Portion of our assistance programs for almost every country is in good governance and democracy, because you're not going to have a failed state, we feel, if you have good, transparent governance and democracy. So, and it's not that it's new. I think the amount of attention, the amount of money going to it is new, and it's raised.
Prior to September 11th, would it have been possible either for the Clinton administration or the Bush administration to say to either the Saudis or the Pakistanis, as the president did after September 11th, you're either with us or against us?
It's not clear how you would have communicated such a message and under what set of circumstances. What would you have been saying to the Pakistanis at that point that would have persuaded them that it was a choice they had to make? After 9/11, it was clear to the Pakistanis that we were going to take action against al-Qaeda, and if that included taking action against the Taliban, if that included going into Afghanistan and removing that regime, we were going to do it. And what we were essentially saying to them at that point, you've got to be with us. And I think without that kind of imperative, 9/11 plus the fact that we were determined to invade a country, if that's what it took, to get rid of this threat, I'm not sure you would have gotten the kind of response from the Pakistanis that we got on the 14th of September.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Commissioner Gorelick.
Jamie
thank you,
Gorelick.
Mr. Chairman, and thank
former,
you, Secretary
formerly
Powell
served in the Clinton administration's
Secretary
Justice
Armitage
Department.
For being here today. Secretary Powell, it's been my pleasure over 25 years to have worked with you in two Democratic administrations. Just to protect you, I will note for the record you were in uniform. it's my pleasure to have the opportunity to question you today. I'd like to return to some questions that Governor Thompson asked you at the outset, and they have to do with the appropriate role of the National Security Council in an area like terrorism, and particularly whether it is mostly a policymaking body, as it seems to have been in the policymaking process leading up to NSPD 9. Directed to counterterrorism, or whether it has an operational role as well. And you have been, I would say, candidly dismissive of the notion that more meetings would have been helpful. But I would note that by putting off until the perfect policy was in place, a decision on flying the Predator, on a decision on arming the Northern Alliance, a decision on the response to the coal, there were operational implications to this, in fairness, prolonged policymaking process. There are gaps of 6 weeks between deputies' committee meetings as this process unfolds. And then during what has been called the summer of threat, where you have the CIA director running around with his hair on fire, you all, the cabinet, was never summoned to the White House to talk. Now, as I take it, your view is it wouldn't have made a difference. Dick Clark has said, well, actually, during the Millennium process, it did make a difference. So I'd like to ask you, Were you aware, for example, that within your department, visas were being issued to the plotters of 9/11 when these individuals in your consulate had no information from the CIA or the FBI that these were bad actors? Were you aware that your tip-off list, which had lists of terrorists who should be prevented from coming into this country, were not being given to the FAA so that those same people wouldn't fly on our aircraft? Did you sit in a meeting with the Attorney General and say to him, have you turned over every rock in your FBI so that I know how to respond as Secretary of State to these threats?
I wasn't being dismissive of meetings as not being useful. I was saying that there are many ways to communicate besides just having principals meetings. I could see the need for an almost daily meeting when I think of the Y2K situation just before New Year's Eve, when the whole world was sort of a buzz as to what was going to happen. That truly was a time that maybe you wanted to meet every single day. But we were not dismissive and did not fail to deal with issues like Predator or Northern Alliance. The Predator was not ready as a weapon during the early months of 2001. Toward the latter part of that seven-month period, more information became available as to the capacity and the capabilities of the Predator as an armed weapon, and we all became more involved in it. And it was moved along at very, very rapid speed through the development process, almost through a skunk works process, and it was used as soon as it was available. So having lots of principals meetings about whether the Predator was or was not armed wouldn't have served any particular purpose, because that isn't the mechanism by which the Predator was being
They're talking about the Predator, which is a drone aircraft used for surveillance, but which might have been used to deliver some kind of weapon.
Coordinating the development of policy. And in a crisis atmosphere, the NSC system also becomes somewhat operational as it pulls people together to deal with a crisis.
Well, I would note that it was operational, but only at the CSG level, which is in most institutions and most organizations in the government, two, three, four levels down. Let me just follow up very quickly on the Predator. The Predator had been used as a surveillance technique. It had been tested up until the end of the Clinton administration, and then it literally was sat on the ground until it could be armed. Did you consider using it as it had been used in Kosovo to survey and then cue laser-guided missiles or other arms not on the Predator?
You'll have to direct. It was used for reconnaissance purposes. And then during the winter season, it was brought back to the United States for work and to start to determine its capability to handle a weapon. There was a time lag between the ability of the Predator to find something on the ground and then to deliver an ordnance from somewhere far away, like a cruise missile from one of the submarines or right. ships at sea. So there wasn't a direct action link in real time between there's a target, hit it. That's what the Hellfire did. It gave you an immediate response, and it was not available until the fall of 2001.
I will direct that question to later witnesses.
On the Northern Alliance, since you raise it,
yeah.
the opinion of our group in whatever form, in whatever form it took this opinion, was that the Northern Alliance only controlled a small portion of Afghanistan at this point. It had been pretty beaten up. It was involved in some activities that we had some serious reservations about, and we did not feel that at that time, during that period, it was ready for a massive infusion of American assistance and what it would have done with such a massive infusion. We didn't think it had the capability to march on Kabul or to take down the Taliban, and that was a judgment. It wasn't a judgment deferred. It was a judgment made at that time. Things changed after 9/11 when we were actually going to put people in with the Northern Alliance to give them the kind of capability that they ultimately acquired with our people.
And in that regard,
on visas, the 19 individuals who got into the United States, there was nothing in the databases until the summer of 2001, when two of them were identified to us, and we immediately took action against the visas that had allowed them into the country. But otherwise, these individuals were would not have tripped anyone's database. There were some discrepancies on the forms they filled out, but they were not the kinds of discrepancies that would have said to you, this is a terrorist, and they could have easily corrected those errors on the application forms and resubmitted them, and there was nothing in our consolidated database that would have said, don't let these individuals in the country because they're terrorists.
Yes, and it's just those sort of gaps that I personally believe can be addressed by having all the relevant parties in the room in a state where there is an emergency. I do want to go on, though. I was struck by your, I think, very candid statement of the degree to which you were apprised of the terrorist risk when you took office and really seized with it. But as I go back and I look at what President Bush listed as his priorities for your department, I think on the day actually that your selection was announced, they were Russia, NATO, China, alliances in the Far East, our hemisphere, the Middle East, and Iraq. And then when I look at Condi Rice's piece in Foreign Affairs describing essentially the Bush campaign's view of the world, it barely mentions terrorism. So I guess my question is, are you saying that your personal priorities were different from that of the administration's?
No, I think terrorism threat and counterterrorism was a priority of the president. If you look at his Citadel speech, while he was still a candidate in the campaign, he touched on it. And throughout the early months and increasingly as we got into the year, he focused more and more on the intelligence information that he was being provided by Director Tenet. I think you'll hear from Director Tenet that a significant percentage of the items in the daily PDB dealt with terrorism.
What percentage of your time do you think you spent on terrorism before 9/11?
I really don't know that I can make such a calculation. It was embedded in almost everything we were doing. But I don't know that I could tell you what percentage of time I spent on that one issue, and probably couldn't tell you what percentage of time I spent on any other issue asking that.
I know it's a difficult question. Our staff statement notes that the national intelligence estimate described our enemy in terms of terrorism as Islamic extremists angry at the United States. And so I was struck by the fact that the national strategy for combating terrorism, which was issued last in February of 2003, doesn't have a single word about jihadists or Islamic extremists. And it looks at terrorism as the enemy, but terrorism is a tool. And it is not